You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Hello, and welcome to the first ever episode of I Know What Scares You. Your regular, rational romp through our guests' spooky, terrifying, and sometimes downright weird experiences. Enjoy the show as your hosts try to figure out what really scares people. Who are we, and why are we particularly qualified to host this podcast? That I don't really know. But anyway, I'm Dr. Kiki Sanford, and after getting a PhD in birds and brains, I traded my lab coat for a microphone, and I have been talking about science ever since. I've hosted lots of shows, like This Week in Science, and covered many topics through the years, and I am so thrilled to get to join this brilliant, amazing crew of evidence-loving miscreant hosts. Who are they? Natalia, you want to start?
Oh, yeah. Hi, I'm Natalia Reagan, and I'm an anthropologist, a comedian, and when I'm not busy chasing spider monkeys in Panama or using my primate expertise to host Bigfoot TV shows, I'm combining science and comedy to spread science literacy to the masses, or at least I try.
And I am Brian Dunning. I'm a member of the National Association of Science Writers, and I'm probably best known as host of the Skeptoid podcast since 2006. I hope that doesn't date me. Looking at the true science, true science and the true history behind urban legends. So my whole jam is trying to understand why so many smart people in the world end up believing so many incredibly weird things, and using that to try and give us all better tools to tell what's real from what's not.
And I am Jonathan Pritchard, a mentalist. I've been traveling the world for about 20 years, entertaining audiences all over the place. I kind of got my start helping at the James Randi Educational Foundation, handling applications for a $1 million challenge to anybody who claims to have genuine paranormal abilities. So I saw all the ways that people tried to scam their way to the money and thought, I can do this better than they can. And that's how I became a mentalist. Ever since, I've been teaching people how the mind works and how it doesn't work so good sometimes. And that's what I'm here to share.
Well, I am, for one, really excited to learn about all those scams you've got going, Jonathan. But I think it's time for us to just get into the show. Starting up, we've got some news.
I'm here to discuss the so-called flying saucers.
Speaking of scams, I've got a real doozy, guys. Hold on to your seats, because we've got a London woman who has fallen in love with an alien. Yes, like David Bowie said, she is loving the alien. And according to the oh-so-reputable Daily Star, Abby Bella complained online that she was sick of silly Earthmen, and apparently her would-be extraterrestrial lover saw her laments, bypassed her DMs, and slid directly into her dreams, and asked her basically to wait for his arrival the next night. And when he rolled up on the flying saucer the next day, she got out of his dreams and into his spaceship, where she was met with five super tall human-like creatures. And don't worry, it doesn't get too freaky deaky, because I was like, oh God, what's happening next? But she did bond with one alien in particular. And basically this modern day gentle alien actually asked for her consent before she would run away with him. And she actually said no, because she was afraid he would take her away forever, which I don't know. That sounds kind of nice given the state of the world these days. So now she's complaining that she regrets her decision and waits nightly with her go bag, like we all have a go bag, and is hoping for her star-crossed alien to return. So guys, what do you make of this fantastic, star-crossed lover tale?
Here's my thing. I mean, when we hear stories like this, and given what I do for a living, these are coming across my desk all day long. I mean, one of two things is probably true. She's making it up, which is usually not the case. And the other thing is that she's either mistaken. I mean, she's obviously mistaken about what this is, what this happened, assuming she's honestly telling a story of what she believes happened. I don't bother to spend a great deal of time on that third possibility that this actually is an alien here. And you know, that's that you're supposed to do that. You're supposed to give, you know, equal time to all possibilities. But I'm sorry, that's not a real possibility. What do you guys think about that? Will you guys give equal time to the goofy possibility?
All I have to say is Ambien is a heck of a drug.
Or fame. By the way, she's an actress in her 30s. That's all it says. She says it's the real deal. She says it's love. And she's been waiting for it.
Yep. Opportunities aren't going to ask you twice, right? That he asked, do you want to come along? And she didn't have an absolute, yeah, let's go. So why would the alien come back for a second tour? It's her missing out.
She's getting ghosted by an alien. That's some stuff.
It must be a pretty slow dating scene on that guy's planet that he comes all the way here.
Yeah, she said she's willing to go to the Andromeda galaxy to basically spend the rest of her days with said alien.
It's a cockpit.
What happened? What happened between the no to the go bag to change her mind? No, I'm not going to go with you now, but okay, now I will go with you if you come back.
It feels very like modern day rom-com where she's kind of that sort of manic pixie girl where she finally gets the guy, but he's not exactly what she expected. And so she's sitting there trying to figure out. But apparently she's waiting, got to go back. I don't know. I think if she did the old standard leave behind or maybe a trail of Reese's Pieces. I mean, we're talking an extraterrestrial here. Let's get creative.
People are willing to do all sorts of crazy things.
We are, and thank you so much for weighing in on that fantastic story of the week. And I heard we have a fantastic guest that Jonathan's about to introduce.
Our guest is probably best known for playing Crichton the Android on the very long-running British TV series Red Dwarf since 1989. And these days, he's making the world cleaner and greener with the super popular streaming program Fully Charged. So please put your hands together for our guest, Robert Llewellyn. How did I do?
Oh,
because your introduction when we were talking, you had the perfect Welsh pronunciation, and my Welsh ancestors are very far in my ancestry, so there was no way I was going to stick that landing.
I can't do it properly. I mean, it's not when I think of my granddad who could do it properly. It's a vague copy of what he used to say. Yeah, no, it's not. It's a complicated language. So then I can't speak Welsh. It is a.
Well, you got the North Carolina mountain pronunciation, so welcome aboard. So what are we going to be talking about? Because the theme is precognition, and as a mentalist, I stand on stage to make it look like I can predict the future. I always like to point out that if I could actually predict the future with any sort of accuracy, I would go to Vegas immediately, and yeah. I wouldn't have to be at this 4 o'clock show in the middle of nowhere. So I want to give you the floor to walk us through your story, be as detailed as you can. Then we'll ask you a whole bunch of questions and take it from there.
It's the only thing that's ever happened in my life where I really couldn't quite work out what had happened. So I've got to go back about 31 years. And I was in Australia. My wife is Australian, so I spent a lot of time in Australia. We were in on the coast of Queensland, which is, if you've never been, very, very spectacular, very beautiful, very, very hot. And I was asleep one night, and I woke up from a proper screaming nightmare where I dreamt that a very good friend of mine, a New Yorker, was trying to kill me and another mutual friend in a swimming pool. And I, the reason the swimming pool thing might not sound scary to most people who, you know, learnt to swim when they were children, I didn't learn to swim until I was 37 when I had children. I couldn't swim. So a dream about being in water where you're out of your depth was by definition very frightening for me. That was it was a really horrible dream because he was a lovely guy. And in the dream, he was furiously angry and very dangerous. And he was a big guy in real life. He was a big guy. Go back to bed, go back to sleep. 2 weeks later, I get a paper letter in an envelope. It was a friend of mine who was in London who wrote me a letter to tell me that this man, Michael, I'll use his name, had died. But on the day that I was that I had that nightmare, he dropped dead in a dentist's waiting room of a massive cardiac arrest. Now, he had had a history of illness in his teens, and he was a chronic chain smoker. Was not a fit guy, but was an extraordinary man. Very, very, really impressive, funny, intuitive, sensitive. There's no way I knew he died. And I definitely had a nightmare which featured him very strongly around the time he died that I didn't find out that he died for at least 2 weeks later, because I know where we were when I got that letter. That is quite hard to explain. You know, that was quite odd. And it's definitely a thing that stayed with me. There's no other experience I've had that is even remotely close to that.
Like that's perfect. Let me ask you a couple of questions, though, just to fill in the details.
Yeah.
In your dream, you had one friend was trying to kill you and another friend in a swimming pool. And which one is the one who died?
Oh, Michael, who was trying to kill me. So in the dream, I'm in a swimming pool with Michael and Sarah. And Michael and I were quite close, but neither of us were as close to each other as we were to Sarah. I don't know if I can explain that politely. This is a long time ago that Sarah was close to both of us, but not at the same time. Not at the same time. There was a bit of overlapping possibly on her part.
We're very inclusive.
But, you know, so there was some... Yes.
I like this.
Yeah, we've got Sarah the most boring part of your whole stories. Like, I need a separate podcast called Things That Interest Me and stories about your Italian girlfriend, your Australian wife,
Mm-hmm. I mean, it took me years to work out that I have never dated a white middle class English woman. Just never happened.
I know someone in London who's looking, and she's done with Earthmen. I'm just throwing that out there.
That's true.
She is Abby Bella. She's in Canary Wharf.
Right, Canary Wharf's lovely area. I could have my Red Dwarf makeup put on and go and visit. That would be quite funny, actually.
I think we're onto something, folks.
Hello, ma'am. I read about you in the Daily Star.
Okay, I'm getting down to brass tacks here. So now, at the time when you had the dream, you're in Australia.
Yeah.
We're assuming it was within a few hours at a minimum, or
maybe within a day or so.
The same day.
Possibly within 20. I think within 24 hours is fair. I think that is
okay. So let me ask you, what about this is the part that specifically seems unusual, inexplicable?
I think certainly one of them is that I'm not prone to nightmares.
Okay.
And I very rarely, I mean, I have written down dreams in my life when I've remembered them because they're quite weird and, you know, how dreams are. But that's quite unusual. So it's not a common experience for me to wake up in the middle of the night really frightened with my heart going crazy. That alone was quite an unusual thing. So say Michael hadn't died, that would still have been quite weird. And so it was the combination of the two. When I then find out that he died, it was that moment where it was like a contra zoom in a cinema. When I opened the letter from Christoph, who is my friend, who told me about Michael, you know, it was like the whole world went whew at that moment. That was quite a strange experience to read that. And that was, I think, it was at least 2 weeks later that I would have received that letter.
So, I mean, this is what you're talking about is it's actually kind of the classic example that we tend to use to explain why things that seem extraordinary coincidental really aren't that surprising to begin with, because I mean, you can make an equation from all of this, and the variables of the equation is how many people does the average person know well enough that they're a friend, yeah, that you might have a dream about them, and it's usually, you know, a couple of hundred. How many days are there in a year? How many years do you live? And then how many people do you know who die over the course of your lifetime? And that's usually, you know, obviously the older you get, that usually ends up being up to a couple of hundred. And when you multiply all of these out, the chances of any two of those things happening, you have a specific dream or thought of someone that you never think of on the same day that they happen to actually die, it actually happens to most people. And when you consider in a country of the size, well, take the world population, you know, what do we have now? 7.5, 8 billion people. How many times a day is that happening? And it's a huge, huge number. And you can tweak those variables a lot up and down and make them as conservative as you want. Yeah. And it's still a huge number of times every day that this seemingly impossibly improbable coincidence is happening. So had you considered that? Had you ever like sat down and said, what are actually the odds of this having happened?
I suppose not in the way that you've structured it, but I mean, I certainly was always suspicious of my own experience, because I'm going, what, how, you know, I think on the instant that I read the letter from Christoph, it was such a shock, because I'd seen Michael literally a couple of days before I left to go to Australia, so maybe 2 months before, and I'd spent I had lunch with him in London, and we had a long talk, and he was fine then. He wasn't like ill. I wasn't expecting it. It was very unexpected. He was 42 years old. He had two small children. Very, very sad. Event for his peers and everyone around him and his kids. So that an instant reaction was absolutely that. This is a psychic wave that Michael sent through the Earth's core to my brain while I was asleep in Queensland. And then I went, yeah, but was it the same time? You know, I was trying to work out the days and go back through my diary. And when were we at that place? What night was it that I had that actual nightmare? You know, how close? So I'm saying now, I'm defending it, say it's within 24 hours. Yeah. It was in the same week. It definitely was in the same week that I had it, but I can't really honestly.
This is kidding. Right. Well, little loser.
Well, it is, because you construct, but you know, you construct it. Absolutely. Yeah. It's a classic case, because I have thought about this since I knew I was coming on here, thinking, wait a minute, how close was it? I just don't know now, because also now I don't have any way of finding the dates that I would have had that dream, because I wrote about it a year later, probably.
Right.
You know, that's, so it's all...
You've just hit it on the head, which is I engineer those experiences for my audiences.
Yeah. Yes.
And I have specific techniques to help you not be able to reconstruct an accurate timeline, so that what you know happened never happened. And I have people argue with me afterwards saying, no, I know that's what you told me you just did, but I know what I saw happen. And you can't, nope. I know that you're psychic. I know that you've got the mojo. And the dream that happens is such a common motif. I use that in my shows where I say, I have these dreams that happen and nobody believes me. So that's why I've taken the habit of writing it all down. And then we go through this whole exercise, and then I show proof that I wrote down these wacky details that people make up. It's all a trick. But I do have that exact kind of thing happen where, yeah, that's how I experienced deja vu, which is I dreamt this was going to happen and now it is. But that it doesn't translate automatically to, well, that now means that physics doesn't exist. Like psychic wavelengths propagate faster through the Earth's core than outer space. So that we can triangulate. No, thank you.
Psychic powers are faster than the speed of light.
They go through liquid metal in the center.
They go all the way to Andromeda.
I'm curious.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Have you ever talked to Sarah about this?
Actually, probably not, no, because she now lives in Italy. She's an artist who lives in a castle on a hill in Italy.
Is this the Italian girlfriend?
No, no. The Italian girlfriend is completely different.
It's a different... She wasn't Italian at the time that they were dating.
No. So there was... Okay, so I'll just do the Italian girlfriend. End of Italian girlfriend. Whole other story. Don't want to bore you. Quite complicated. Italian girlfriend now very happily lives in France, has a lovely son and a lovely husband. And we get on with her fine and we stayed there and it's lovely. Gap between Italian girlfriend and Australian wife, some other stuff happened, which included Sarah and some other stuff. I don't want to go into that. You know, I was young.
That's okay.
I was young and very, very responsible and very, very standoffish. The women made the approaches, not me. I just want to point that out very clearly. And I'm shocked at how sometimes women do make approaches.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen anymore. It's a great relief. Now I'm very old. I get no approach. I'm very happy not to have approaches. But
yeah, and there's also the question of, you know, whether or not you did have something in your daily life that would have triggered a memory of either Sarah or Michael. And because you had the overlap with Sarah, perhaps your brain would automatically, with Michael with Sarah, you know, maybe your brain would automatically connect these things. And our brains are these amazing networks of association. And this thing is associated with that thing, which is another. And so you have this combination of possible triggers within your daily life that would lead to a your brain processing information about what you've seen, what you've heard, what you've thought, and memories that you possibly have had. Put that into a metaphorical dream context, which it was about death, but it wasn't Michael's death. It was your he was trying to kill you, right? So, you know, that kind of metaphor is usually there's something in your life that's like a transition or something. Your brain's figuring something out on a on a bigger scale. It doesn't necessarily mean death, because dreams are rarely
seen. Absolutely.
You know, I could throw another wrench into here because I've
I love your wrench.
You know how when you have a dream about someone and you're trying to explain the dream to your wife or someone the next day, you'll say, you know, and Joe was in the dream, but it wasn't Joe. It was Jim. And people kind of blend together. And so in some of the research I've done, I've read a lot of these dream studies where, you know, they put people in a special room and they, you know, have the EEGs on them and everything. And when people wake up immediately after having a dream and they describe it, they might name some people, or they might say it was Joe, but it was Jim, but it looked like Bob or something like this. And then in the morning, when they write about it, it's often a different person. And then sometimes in some of these studies, they will introduce people that the person actually knows and actually change who the memory is of who was in the dream.
Yeah.
So when you say that the dream was... Michael was killing you and Sarah in the pool. Is that right?
Yeah.
I wouldn't be at all surprised that if you had woken up right after and I'd asked you who was in the dream, you could have named two different people.
Right. Yeah, possible. I mean, the other thing that I know Judy would argue is it wasn't Michael and it wasn't Sarah. You know, it wasn't them, because it was my dream. It was what was happening in me. So it was nothing to do with them, actually. As well, I think is very other key.
Yeah.
You know, she would say, you know, I dreamt that I was walking along the street with Adolf Hitler. Yeah, all right. It wasn't Adolf Hitler.
Yeah, and I like the Jungian archetype of the shared backstory, and now this motivation of your friend who you thought was a bosom buddy was now upset with your previous relationship with Sarah, and he's trying to kill you. This representation of water, of struggle. Yeah, you could get very Jungian on it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That was proper Jungian stuff. Yeah, yeah. No, good quality.
I love it.
Yeah, for all of this, though, I think that the, you know, our memory mechanisms and how they work, to Brian's point also of that kind of malleability, especially when you're in a dream state and when you're remembering something, your memory is open. That neural network is capable of change. And so the neuroplasticity that is inherent in our brain is capable of actually changing the memory as we are remembering
it.
And that's like an aspect of how we're moving forward in different kinds of therapy, PTSD type stuff. Yeah. But for dreams, because you wake up and you're in this very, this state that is able, it's malleable. Mm. You can make dreams what you want them to be, change the state, change all sorts of details in the process of the memory actually being crystallized as you come back to consciousness, full consciousness. Yeah. But what's also interesting is there's actually a study out this week in, I think it's in like Science or Science Advances or something, but researchers had people look at images and then fMRI mapping of brain activity to find out what areas of the brain were active as people were assessing images that they hadn't seen before. And what they found is that the hippocampus is actually involved in retrieving old information. So basically framing what you're seeing in present with what you've seen in the past. And so everything that happens in our past is actually creating our present and the way we see the future. And so, you know, our hippocampus goes, oh, this is something new. Let's re-encode things and tell a different story. But basically, this is like your brain is like, I'm going to keep going back to this. It's our brain telling us a story. And then it just coincidentally happened to be around this unfortunate time of Michael's passing.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And I mean, I think that's the thing. I mean, I'm very happy to wrap this up, but I think that it's absolutely a skill set that I've developed in the last 45 years. I've tried to write a book and I eventually gave up, called Embroidery for Boys. And the whole idea was I watched my son do it. So my son would have had a genuine fall from his skateboard. That really happened in real life. I saw him do it and he hurt his knee. This is when he's like 12. And we were in a skate park. And then later I'd hear him explain that event to his mates. And he'd say, I fell off the knee and my kneecap came right off. And dad had to pick it up and take me to hospital. You know, it was like massive exaggeration. But the actual start of that story was real. And then I absolutely recognized that. I went, that is my life. Because that's what you do when you're a performer or you're a storyteller. You know, I did trip over and fall down and hurt my ankle. But in the story I'm telling you, the hole was 4,000 feet deep. And actually it was lava at the bottom and there was a dragon. You know.
It's really amazing that you survived.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, it's incredible.
It's a miracle. I am actually a superhero. Yeah, Christmas all that stuff. Miracle. And boys, I'm sure women do it as well, but it's just I was so aware of that thing, you know, that I did write about it in the end, but it's not that interesting in a way. But, you know, I think that is, there was a bit of embroidery around that dream when I really look at the reality of what happened.
Mm-hmm.
I think the one thing I'm going to hold on to, Brian, is I definitely had the dream before I knew Michael was dead. That's all. That's absolutely, that is rock solid fact. Yeah. Everything else is up
for grabs. If that's the case, then I'm backpedaling and I say it is inexplicable.
I love it. And also that embroidery, that's the explanation for my whole career.
Yes,
what I
exactly,
do
exactly.
is mediocre, but people seem to remember it as being fantastic.
It is mediocre.
So that's great. At best. At best.
Ryan!
That's a terrible thing.
But you'll remember it as marvelous. That's the trick.
Yes.
That's the best trick. So we definitely appreciate you going into those lascivious tangents as well and sharing so much of your very personal background and history.
But a long time ago.
Yes, a long time ago and a lifetime far, far away. you've also got a lot of other stuff going on, very creative, putting out a lot of fun stuff. So what are some other things that you want to put on people's radar that they may not know about you, or things that people should look up about you?
Oh, I mean, well, I mean, the thing I'm working on, you know, it's become a very full-time job, is the show I make called Fully Charged, which is about, you know, the future of energy and transport, I suppose, in the broadest terms, and the possibility that we are going through whatever number, I don't know, third or fourth industrial revolution. I mean, it's certainly on a colossal scale, the shift. But one of the things that fascinates me, I'm trying to find a way of developing that more, and really needs other people because it's beyond my pay grade, is the psychology of human beings when faced with a very minor shift in the technology they live with. It is quite extraordinary. So the kind of deep trauma that I have to say mostly men experience when faced with the prospect of having to not drive a combustion car and drive an electric one. I mean, it's no big deal. They're just cars. You're going to not drive a car that goes vroom. You're going to drive a car that goes huh. That's, you know, that's about as deep as it goes. And yet the trauma that we experience on a daily basis in comments, in tweets, in all that stuff is, I don't quite understand where that's coming from. It's in a sense similar to a dream. It's not about the actual technology. It's about something far deeper and more traumatized in the person. But anyway, that's what we're doing. So
well, my thought was, why can't you just add, you know, like some vroom vroom to an electric car? Well, that, you know, just you can, kind of fake it till you make it. Why not? Yeah. Yeah, whatever will get
Natalia,
people
I'm just
to
say
sign
this.
On.
But when I got my Tesla, the first thing I did was tear that speaker out. Those little exterior fake sounds that it makes, I cannot stand those.
Yeah.
Very...
The one that the sound that the Porsche Taycan makes. Let me just say,
I have heard that.
Cool.
I've not. Well, I've heard what you said. Yeah. I have not heard the sound though.
Wow.
Yeah, that is quite a cool sound.
But maybe sometimes those sounds aren't about you, Brian.
Yeah, they're about other
maybe
people.
Maybe those sounds are.
Look, if you want to have this debate, yes, Brian, I have this debate all day long because it presumes that the only reason drivers don't plow down every pedestrian they see is that they're relying on them to hear the engine.
Right. I'm going to get you a ice cream truck sound to have playing out your speaker. Yeah. That's what I'm going to get, Brian.
Yeah, that one
just you wait.
I have met a Tesla owner because the Teslas at the moment, now they do in the UK, they have to have a reversing noise. So they now have when you're in reverse, that's the only dangerous time. When you're going forwards, it's stupid. It's complete nonsense. But when you're reversing out of a car park space, say in a supermarket or something, that you've got to really keep your eye out because that is so quiet. Well, now they do make a noise out the back, but I met a guy who'd put duck sound. So when he reverses, it goes backwards. Quite cute.
I love that.
Just mother like a ducker. Little,
yeah, some mother ducks and some baby ducklings. That's quite sweet. I like.
Oh man, I like that.
Mm. Outstanding.
Oh man.
Well, dude, thank you so much for sharing so much of your interest and background.
Yeah, maybe a little too. I was trying not to share too much.
We'll stick the landing on.
Can
those
you come
duck
back
sounds.
Every week?
We need that. I need that as a custom ringtone. And I would be remiss if I didn't ask for the fans out there. I heard a rumor that there was a 90-minute Red Dwarf special in the works that, due to 2020 being what it is, was delayed. So if there's any kind of juicy tidbit you would be able to share before the sun gets a hold of these details, I would be forever in your debt.
Yeah. I mean, the only thing I can say, because we really don't know, is that we've all agreed to do another series. There was an addendum from the producers, if you're still alive, which is a little bit chilling because the cast is getting on a bit. But there was one moment when a genetically engineered life form that was chasing us down a corridor overtook us because it was a young man in a costume and he was much too fit and we were all too old and knackered. We couldn't run fast enough. So that was a bit embarrassing. Yeah, that was awkward.
Can you give us a Crichton sign-off?
Hello, my name is Crichton 2X4B523P. Such a jerky middle name. That was sort of how it
Yay.
Ended up. Anyway, thank you so much for having me on. And I feel very refreshed now that I've worked through my dream. And I would like to thank the Dream Analysis Group for your input.
Most welcome. All right, well, it's time for our Talked About Tall Tales. Cue the special Talked About Tall Tales music. there. That was cool. going with today's theme of precognition, our talked about tall tale this week is Nostradamus. Nostradamus, born in 1503, today you'd say that he was psychic. He is said to have predicted all of these things in the future. I'm going to read this little paragraph about the history of Nostradamus, and I think this represents what almost anyone has actually heard about him. See, he was a Jew who converted to Christianity. He inherited his prophetic abilities from the Israelite tribe of Issachar. He was educated by his grandfathers, who were doctors in the court of King René of Provence. Nostradamus went to Montpellier in 1521 to study medicine, and was so successful that he stayed on there and became a teacher himself. After his wife and two children died from the plague, he studied and became a leading expert on the dreadful disease. He used advanced antiseptics and recommended a diet low in fat with plenty of good exercise. A noted astronomer, he deduced that the planets went around the sun even before Copernicus. Known for writing his prophecies, he was persecuted by the Spanish Inquisition for heresy, and was even placed on the Vatican's Index of Forbidden Books in 1781. Nostradamus adopted a very religious lifestyle to protect himself, but continued his magical pursuits in private. Once in Italy, he suddenly bowed before a young Franciscan friar for no apparent reason, and later that young friar became the Pope. His astrological forecasts and books of prophecies, called the Centuries and written in codes and anagrams, sold well and made Nostradamus quite celebrated. He used a bowl of water called a magic mirror to assist him in writing his predictions. Nostradamus predicted the date of his own death in 1567 in his Presage 141. He had himself buried upright so that nobody could walk on his grave. And most extraordinarily of all his predictions, when his body was dug up and moved during the French Revolution, workers were astonished to find him wearing a medallion engraved with that very day's exact date. Okay, so let me ask, have most of you heard anything, any of those facts on that list? Anyone heard any of them?
No.
Okay.
I have not.
Well, we're just going to trash this whole segment.
Not going to lie,
okay.
But
well,
no.
Anyway, that's basically that's the version that you're going to get on any of these TV shows about Nostradamus or anything. And what I love about this paragraph, and the reason I read this paragraph, is that without exception, every single thing in that paragraph is false. Because what is known about Nostradamus includes none of those things. These were all invented basically in 20th century pulp fiction, when he kind of became this character, this great, you know, wizard sort of prognosticator character.
Okay, thanks. Well,
he was actually a little bit known during his lifetime. It was for cookbooks. He wrote cookbooks.
Were they cookbooks for the future?
I guess right? He wrote it today because you're going to cook it tonight. So in that sense, yes. So it's just fascinating to me that today there's this need for predictions to be real is so great that people just eagerly cling to this pure fiction. Essentially, everything that's written about Nostradamus is pure fiction. The things that you'll hear, like, oh, he predicted Hitler because in one of his quatrains it had the word hister or something like that. All of these things, everything that he's said to have predicted, 9/11, I mean, it just goes on and on. It all comes down to modern authors coming up with ways to rearrange his words and decode non-existent codes in what he wrote to make it say whatever the heck they wanted to say. There's certainly nothing like any of the popular claims actually in any of his writing. So that's the talked about tall tale and how it relates to precognition.
Yeah, I almost feel like we could all take a week and all make our own predictions and just, you know, make our little you know, I don't know, our scroll and tuck it away for a year and see if any of them come true in a year. I don't know, guys. How do you feel about that? Let's just make some big old predictions for the next, you know, next few
there's
years.
There's the group in Australia that actually does that, the Australian Skeptics. I think every decade, and they've been doing this for some time, they write down, or it might be even every year, they write down all of the published predictions from all the celebrity psychics because Australia has its own newspapers,
psychic.
Like the Star. You are psychic.
For science, I do it every year. We have on This Week in Science, we have our annual prediction show, and we predict. Yes, we predict what will happen. And then at the end of the year, and then we recap the next year to see how many we got right or how many we got wrong. And what was really interesting is that my co-host Justin, some years back, he used to constantly predict that this is the year that we are going to find the Higgs boson. And I would say, no, we're never going to find this. We're not going to find the Higgs boson. That's not it. This is like this particle that doesn't really exist. It's not a thing. And we stuck with those predictions for a long time. And then all of a sudden, it happened. And we scientists, physicists detected the Higgs boson. And so Justin got one right 1 year. After getting it wrong for a lot of years, but it, you know, basically it was Justin. Another year, he also predicted the results of the Super Bowl.
That's my territory. Okay, completely useless predictions that I can only reveal after the fact. That's my method.
I can predict every Super Bowl winner with 50% accuracy within 24 hours of the game starting.
I like to predict the results of football matches based on the names of the teams. So like if it's the Bears versus the Stallions, then I'm like, oh, Bears have teeth and claws and they're totally going to kill the Stallions, you know. And so I try. Yeah, it's kind of like a wildlife.
Yeah, that's like predictions. Mammal March Madness. They do Mammal March Madness, yes. And it's very similar. You know, and as somebody who loves, you know, it's kind of like how in the years I've bought wine based on what animals are on the wine label. You know, that's how I like the teams. You know, thank you. I dig dolphins. They're cool. Give me a panther. Great, yeah. I'm into it.
Yeah. All right. Well, I guess that summarizes all of precognition right there. Okay, Kiki, I'm going to hand it back over to you to wrap us up.
Thanks to Robert Llewellyn for joining us and telling his story. Please subscribe to our podcast. Join us on Facebook and Twitter at IKWSY. Did you listen to this podcast? We want to know more about you. Have you ever dreamed of a future event? Take part in our poll on Twitter or Facebook at IKWSY. And if you have a story that you want to share with us, something that scared you or that was weird, or if you just want to comment on our commentary on this show, then let us know at 888-55-SCARY. That's 888-557-2279. You can give us a call. All calls will be recorded. Please leave your contact details if you want to be considered for inclusion in the show. Everyone out there, join us next week for our next guest, Kyle Hill. Thank you, everyone, for joining us.